Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Curtis Gadsden. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Curtis A. Gadsden. I'm a native Detroiter, born and raised in Detroit. In fact, I started my career in Detroit at WJBK Channel 2, and then went from Channel 2 to Channel 4, WDIV, and a lot of stuff happened.
Yeah. And we'll get into it. So, you're from Detroit like me. I'm from the East Side, Casual and Mac, but I went to high school in Romulus.
Oh, okay.
My father. So I go to high school in Detroit. But, where'd you go to high school?
McKenzie High School.
So can you talk about what it was like growing up in Detroit?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, pretty much in Detroit's heyday. I was reading an article the other day that said Detroit in the 60s was the richest city in the world. And Black folks lived very good in Detroit. And Black folks had a lot of power in Detroit. So I grew up, with the understanding of Black people could basically do anything and be anything because that's what I saw. Right. When you grew up in Detroit, you see Black people as judges, you see them as doctors, you see them as lawyers, you see Black people doing everything. Mm-hmm. So my vision of Black people and myself was very healthy. And my mother added to that. My father was a Baptist minister. Mm-hmm. And my mother was the original church lady. the original church lady. And my parents divorced when I was 8, but I spent a lot of my time with my mother and with my father back and forth. But when I would go to church, I would go to my mother's church, and she was a AME Zion. And in that church, I was altar boy and sang in the choir and Boy Scout, that whole ball of wax. I go to my father's church, and he was the minister, he was the pastor, so I was basically the PK. So I didn't get any breathing room. There was no. So pretty much led a pretty strict early upbringing, and the only time that I can remember that it was pretty dicey was the riots. I lived through the Detroit riots. I was there, and that was a time when everything changed and everything shifted. And I remember when the riots started, I had my father's car, and my mother took the keys so I couldn't drive and locked me and my brothers in the house. Mm-hmm. It was a good thing she did that because my friends a lot of them ended up in really bad trouble, locked up in all kinds of insanity. So that move with my mother was a pretty good move. Yeah, I remember all of that. Yeah. And I used to have dreams about that. That stuff will stick with you for a long, 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 long time. So, after that, things begin to change, but I still had that image of African Americans being able to do whatever they wanted to do, and it was spurred on by my mother. Let me go back before the riots. When I was about 8 years old, my mother used to work at a place called Woman's Hospital. Mm-hmm. I think it's Hutzel Hospital now. Mm-hmm. And she was an elevator operator. And they switched from having elevator operators to automated elevators. Mm-hmm. And she was out of a job. She came home and, she was out of a job and, she was very upset. A day or two later, they called her and offered her a job as in housekeeping, as a maid. And she had grown up in the South, and that was just not sitting well with her. Mm-hmm. You know, going from an elevator operator to the maid was a backward move, and she didn't want to do a backward move. Yeah. She wanted to progress and go further. Long story short, a few years later, my mother got her act together, and my mother ended up being a cancer researcher at the same hospital for the top cancer researcher in Detroit. She became the second in his command doing cancer research. So that taught me all things are possible. Mm-hmm. You know, and so from my mother, I got, don't worry about it, just stay focused and keep going forward. And if you don't give up, you can make it. You know, she really taught me that there may be people that are smarter than you, just don't let anybody outwork you. Mm-hmm. Nobody should be able to outwork you. Mm-hmm. And so that was my mantra all throughout my career and all throughout my working career, you know, that never let anybody outwork me.
Yeah.
Because it's always going to be somebody smarter than you. Mm-hmm. But allowing someone to outwork you is you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I taught that to my children, and that's been, you know, our mantra. I know you interviewed my son.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and yeah, Corey, and you know, taught that to he, his brother, his sisters, everybody got the same grandma story. You know, so growing up in Detroit was good. I mean, it was good because, you know, I saw things that other people didn't seem to have or didn't seem to see.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me, you know. So that was that stuck with me until I got into media. Mm-hmm. Once I got into media, I began to understand, yeah, things are different.
Yeah, we'll get into that. what is like a favorite tradition your family had growing up?
Every night, my parents would come home from work, and we would sit around. You ate at the table. The whole family ate at the table every night. Mm-hmm. Every night. And they find, okay, what's going on with you? What's going on with you? What's with the school thing? How come you're not getting the grade you're supposed? That was the tradition that happened, mm-hmm. without fail. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother and my stepfather would hold court during dinner, mm-hmm. you know, and go around the table to all the children, you know, what's going on, what's happening, and that whole. So that's the thing I remember most. Other than. my brother, my younger brother, ever since he was he was a little guy, mm-hmm. my job was to wake him up at night so he didn't wet the bed. And so every night I would wake up and I would wake my brother up and so he wouldn't wet the bed. Mm-hmm. And that getting up a couple of times every night has stuck with me till this day.
Oh,
I still get up a few times a night out of habit, just because that was my job. And I took my job, my younger brother, that was my job, you know. And I was a pretty good singer in those days as a kid.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, did you have a singing career? Because you have Kiss You, Fired Up, In the Middle of the Night, Can I Get a Witness, Listen to My Heartbeat. And I saw, like, were you also a part of a group called The Strides?
Yeah. I was part of that group back in the day. Now this story I was told by my parents. I don't remember it, but I was told that when I was 9 or 10, that Berry Gordy had come to the house and wanted to talk to them about signing me as an artist. But my mother was afraid to say yes because my father, the Reverend, mm-hmm. would have lost his mind. That was not going to happen. Mm-hmm.
So they turned that opportunity down, but I kept singing. And once I got old enough into my teens, my late teens, you know, in high school, I was high school honors choir. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was also ROTC in high school. So I, you know, I did all touch all those bases, and I became a pretty good singer. Mm-hmm. And parlayed that into I met a guy by the name of Dick Scott. Dick Scott had worked for Motown for years, and he knew Holland Dozier Holland, mm-hmm. that team, and he put me together with them. Nothing ever happened, but he put me together with them. They liked what I did, what I was doing, and wanted to record me. But I think they were going through a time when they were having some issues and the company was having some issues. So that never panned out. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening was Dick ended up moving to New York and working for CBS Records. And I ended up going into television. Yeah. Yeah. And Dick ended up being the brains behind New Kids on the Block. Fast forward to the 80s. Mm-hmm. I was working for Post Newsweek Television. Mm-hmm. And doing a show called Saturday Night Music Machine, which was a precursor to all these talent shows today. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Dick called me and he says, "I want you to come work for me and, you know, do all these videos and movies and stuff." And I'm like, "Okay, what are you talking about?" He said, "I got these five little white guys." Mm-hmm. He said, but they can't sing. And I'm like, "What? What are you talking about? You're asking me to quit my job with the Washington Post, Post Newsweek, come to work for you, mm-hmm. with five little white guys that can't sing?" He said, "Yeah, but they just don't worry about that. We're gonna take care of them. They're gonna be bigger than the Beatles." I'm like, "Dick, man, I can't." No. The guy who took the job ended up making over $10 million. Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like you come from a time where people actually had to see right. And so this is a new area. Like, now it's normal for people to not know how to sing, but back then it's like
you had to actually do it. You know, there was no auto tune. You had to get out there and then
coming from Detroit, like,
exactly.
So like, being from Detroit, it's just like we're just so blessed.
Exactly.
Motown, like, even if you go into the gospel, it's so funny how, like, Southern people will, I don't know if they think we become white when we go to the North or something, but it's like, yeah, we have church the same way y'all have church. I don't know what y'all think. But, like, to have, like, Southern people sometimes think they have a monopoly on, like, gospel, and it's like, but the Clark sisters, Dietrich Haddon, the Winans, like, and then if you add in Chicago too, it's like all your favorite people are from Detroit or Chicago.
Exactly. So end up going to work for IATSE, the stagehands union in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Had to threaten a lawsuit in order to do it, but they let me in, and I learned so much by working for that union on the job, you know. But let me back up. Before even that happened, before I even met Dick Scott, when I was back as a teenager, just coming out, my first real job was working at Dodge Main Assembly Plant in Hamtramck. I took that job because my mother wanted me to work in the factory.
Yeah,
that was her thing. Right. Yeah, yeah. You have to, when you graduate from high school, you know, if you're not going to go to college, then you have to get a job in the factory, and the factory is paying really good money, and yada, 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 yada. I just didn't want to do that. I was like, "Mom, why? It's good money. You need to do that." Okay, fine. So I ended up going, first I went to Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. I lasted one day. I walked in there and I saw fire shooting all over the place and it was hot. And I'm like, no, this is, I walked in the building. I worked a few hours and I was like, you know, y'all got this, son. Nah, I left.
Y'all keep.
And it was, I was so against it to where I didn't go back to pick up my check. I didn't. My mother was like, you didn't take the pick up your check. I said, no, that's, I learned a good lesson. That's not for me. No. So I ended up quitting that job. But then I had, you know, she kept after me. So I went, ended up working for Chrysler, mm-hmm. for Dodge, Maine. Mm-hmm. And my father had told me that if you're going to work in the factory, the place to be was the unions. So I began to find out about the unions, and I ended up running for political office, mm-hmm. and became the youngest union steward, I think, at that time in the UAW. I was 21 years old. Nice. And I had hundreds of men who followed me, and that was a turning point in my life. Because I'm 21 years old, and men and women who are older than me, some of them a lot older than me, like my parents' age, right. were following me and my advice. Mm-hmm. That was a heavy burden, and it was scary. Yeah. And so I ran for office, and I won. And I began to look at what was going on in the factory. And being the choir boy that I was, mm-hmm. the altar boy that I was, there were some things there happening there that I was opposed to. And I was hell bent on changing them. Mm-hmm. At that time, there were, when men would get their checks, men and women get their checks on the afternoon shifts, before they could leave the building, there were prostitutes and gamblers, prostitution and gambling right outside the plant. Mm-hmm. And so I objected to that. And it was happening to Black people. And I was like, at that time, I was like, Black power. I was like, Black Lives Matter didn't have nothing on me. I was like, you are not doing this to my people. Right. No. So I protested it, and nobody did anything. So I put it in writing, in a grievance, in a union grievance, and sent it up the chain. Mm-hmm. And that's when things started to get strange, because I didn't know, I didn't have the street sense, yeah, to know that I didn't know about that. I was the one who was surprised. Nobody else was surprised, but I was hell bent on changing it still. So I put a grievance in, nothing happened. And I kept putting grievances in, and I get a call from somebody higher up in the UAW who called me and wanted to have a meeting with me. And they told me, young man, you're 21 years old, you have a great future. You just need to relax. And I was like, you are not doing this to my people. Right. So I went to the media, took my story to the media. I didn't know how powerful the union and the company were. The media wouldn't touch it, wouldn't touch those stories. Me and my mother's telling me, you always trying to change the world. Quit trying to change the world. I'm like, this is not right. I got in my car, drove across the Ambassador Bridge to Canada, mm-hmm. to CKLW. Mm-hmm. They put me on the air and I told my story. All hell broke loose. I mean, it was It was in the papers. It was bad.
Yeah.
And stuff started happening. And there was, I think it's out of sequence. I think this happened before that, but there was a walkout. Mm-hmm. And it was the group I represented was called Group 13. And it was really supposed to be really bad. I don't remember, but they walked out of the building and stopped the entire plant, shut down production. So ordinarily they should be fired. Mm-hmm. But this happened on a Friday. So when the plant stopped, when everything stopped, I gathered them all up and told them, go with me. We all going down to file a discrimination lawsuit against the company. Mm-hmm. Now, I did that because of two things. One, I knew the discrimination lawsuit took about 5 days for it to hit. Mm-hmm. I knew in order for them to fire as many people as they were going to fire, it would take 10 to 15 days. Mm. So I knew the paperwork would beat their paperwork and nullify the whole thing. So I did that, and sure enough, everybody got off. After that, they thought I was Jesus. I mean, I could walk on water, but the company, stuff started happening to me that I had to have a hard time to this day thinking that it was just coincidence.
Right.
I started getting stopped by the police. On a regular basis, and I had never had any issue with the police. Mm-hmm. But suddenly a police car get behind me and I'm got issues, and they stopped me and pulled me. I was on Livernois and Warren. Mm-hmm. And they pulled their guns out and pulled me out of the car, and luckily it drew a crowd. Mm-hmm. And they said, "You were speeding." I said, "Okay." And they said, "But we're not going to give you a ticket. You just go ahead." Now, why would you pull your guns out, pull me out of the car, I'm speeding, and you decide not to give me even a ticket?
Right.
I was like, nah. Something wrong with this picture.
Yeah.
So I ended up resigning, and that's when I met Dick Scott. When I stopped, because I went back to trying to sing. I met Dick Scott, and that whole thing happened. But, so those were my Detroit days, the early days, until I got with WDIV and became a stage manager for 6 and 11 o'clock news.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, because I don't know the order of these things, but let's start with, like, you wrote the Bless You Boys song.
Mm-hmm. That was a WDIV. Okay. Myself and Randy Jacobs.
How did that come about, and what was the impact of it on Detroit?
How did that come about? I got called into my boss's office, and we had done. I think this was after we had done the Go For It campaign. Mm-hmm. We did a campaign, a marketing campaign. Well, let me start it. When I was at JBK Channel 2, I did my first show. It aired 8/8/1978 at 8. The first show I'd ever co-produced, wrote, directed, and hosted, starred in. And that show got me, I believe it was two local Emmys.
Nice.
Two or three. I don't remember, but it was the first time that somebody of color had got multiple Emmys. Mm-hmm. in one shot. That was my first show I ever did. But from that show, that's when I went to DIV. They hired me away. So they hired me away to do the Go For It campaign.
Yeah.
To help them do the Go For It campaign. And what Go For It was, it was the a campaign to find a singer and a spokesperson for the channel. Because it had just been acquired by Post Newsweek Television. So they were new in town. And let me tell you a story. The thing, The thing I remember about my first few days at WDIV was my first day, there was a picket outside of DIV. Mm-hmm. Black folks were picketing about a show called Beulah Land that NBC was about to run. And there was they were protesting. My first day on the job, and they called me in and said they wanted me and one other guy, a guy by the name of Bob Warfield, good guy. He was another brother who was there, and he was in the news division. I think he was an executive producer over the news, a director over the news, something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they had the both of us go out and try to calm down this crowd of black people. Mm-hmm. And it was my first. This is the first thing I had to do when I got on the job. And I'm like, I don't know what Beulah Land is. Well, is this a real place? I mean, what is, I didn't know what the show was.
Yeah.
I just knew that they needed somebody black to go out and talk to these people. So I went out, Bob and Warfield and I went out, and we talked to these people and we calmed them down. Warfield went back in and I stayed out there and talked to them. Well, out of that, I think it was a little while after that, Catherine Graham came to town. Mm-hmm. Now, Catherine Graham was one of the most powerful women in media at that time. She owned Washington Post. She owned Post Newsweek Television. She came to town, and it was lunchtime, and I was sitting out in front, and I had a paper bag lunch. I had a sandwich in my... Catherine Graham came out and sat down with me, mm-hmm, and shared my paper bag lunch. And she began to ask me questions about what I thought black people what that channel should do, mm-hmm, to be accepted in a chocolate city.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there now, all like, this is Catherine Graham. She reached into the White House and pulled out a president. And she's sitting here asking me. Uh-huh. I mean, I was like, what? It was surreal.
Yeah.
But you know, we talked for a while and I told her some of the things I thought. Anyway, out of those conversations, my boss came to me one day and they had this campaign they wanted to do called Go For It. Mm-hmm. And we had auditions for singers to sing the Go For It song and brought in producers from Los Angeles, and it was a big, huge campaign. The lines were down the street and around the corner to people were auditioning, and we ended up doing this successful campaign. And from that came the next campaign was the Tigers. The Tigers were doing really, really good the year before.
Before you move to the Tigers, can I ask you this question? So, mm-hmm, you were the producer for the Go For It campaign. You said it was challenging to take like the raw talent and draw the best out of them to produce like professional content. And so I know like currently like working at an animation studio and like I get to go to like the recording sessions for the voice actors, and like taking direction is a skill set. I realize. And I've only been in this role since January. So, you know, it's about like people knowing what their voice sounds like, listening to someone tell them to change it, and then being capable of taking the note and outputting a different sound is harder, mm-hmm, than it seems. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to how you go about taking people with the talent and like drawing that out of them and polishing them up?
Well, interesting enough, that I had learned that skill from being in a recording studio. When you go in the studio as a performer, not every producer can get the best out of you.
Yeah.
One of the problems with Holland, Dozier, Holland, when Edward Holland first got with me, is they didn't really know what to do with me because I had a huge voice. I didn't need a microphone. You could just turn the microphone down because I'm boom. And so I got to a guy by the name of, through Dick Scott and that whole ordeal, I got through to a guy who became one of my best friends. His name was John Maxey. Mm-hmm. And John had a relationship with one of the Motown guys by the name of Ivy Hunter. Mm-hmm. And Ivy had written Dancing in the Street, Martha, he had written for with Marvin Gaye on a bunch of stuff. So Ivy got me in the studio as my producer. Okay. And I'm in there and I'm just bailing, just whoa. And he said, stop. He said, you know you have a microphone in front of you, right? I was like, yeah. He said, well, let the microphone do the work. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I used to sing it in church.
Right.
In church, you just let it fly. But in the recording studio, it was a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So Ivy taught me how to really express my emotions vocally and do that whole thing and how to get it out. Well, when we did the Go For It campaign, I just fell back on my training. And when we started to Jan, I think Jan Spencer, when we chose Jan, and it was the first time she had been in the studio.
Right.
So she was just singing. She was just singing. And she wasn't singing from her heart.
Right.
And so I used a technique that had been used on me. Mm-hmm. And I told her, I said, here's what I want you to do. You're just singing. I don't want you to just sing. I want you to feel it. Mm-hmm. And she didn't really understand what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I said, here's what I want you. I want you to close your eyes right now. Mm-hmm. Hold my hands. And I want you to think about the worst thing you've ever had to overcome. And I want you to feel that thing. Mm-hmm. I want you to go back to that time and experience that thing. I take a deep breath. She took a deep breath. And I said, just go back to that time when it was so painful, but you had to keep going. You had to keep going. You had to keep going. And she started to cry. And I walked out of the room, told the engineer, roll the tape. Mm-hmm. And she just crying and came out with that performance. So I learned that whether you were singing or acting or whatever discipline, whatever creative discipline you had to put your heart and your feelings into it, or else it's just chatter. It's if you don't feel it, the audience not gonna feel it.
Right.
You know, and you know, so I had to do that. That's how I would get the best out of singers, out of actors, out of people who were in front of the camera. I had to take them through some kind of emotional experience.
Yeah.
In order to get the best out of them.
There's this comedian, Michael Jr., and mm-hmm. he has this clip that I played over and over again. Like when I was president of the Urban League of Young Professionals in New Orleans, we would do a new member orientation. I would play this video every time. So he's a stand-up comedian, and he does like crowd work. And there was like an older black gentleman in the crowd, and he, you know, he's a singer or whatever. And so he's like, oh, sing Amazing Grace. And so this is he's a teacher. He's like classically trained. He starts singing like operatic Amazing Grace. And then Michael Jr. is like, okay, now pretend your mama got shot. you know, the hood version. And then the same black man did the best version of Amazing Grace and like tore down the house. And it was like, and so Michael Jr. then goes to like, at first he knows what he was singing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he knew why he was singing it. And so
exactly.
I would take that clip and like go around and be like, okay, what's your why of why you joined the Urban League movement?
Right.
Yeah,
that I started using that technique on everything because I mean, that's what Ivy did with me.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at some of the stuff I did, there's a second name that's got records and that's really me. It's called the name is Kurt Darin, CURTDARIN.
I saw that on the because I was like, okay, because it was your stuff at the top of the blog and then
right.
Kurt. I was like, what is this?
Yeah, that was my AKA.
Okay.
Ivy wanted me to take on. I hated that name, but if you listen to that, mm-hmm. and you listen to the stuff I did with Bless You Boys and stuff I did on television, it's two different people.
Okay.
Two different people. Just, you know, And
Sasha Fierce, like with Beyonce.
right. Because one, I had to feel, and one, I just had to do, you know. So, you know, yeah, that's it. And you have to, I carried that through all the stuff I did, you know, when I was directing, mm-hmm. you know, when we did Comic View, the comics were used to doing stage shows mm-hmm. and doing stage performances. And I had to get across to them. There were 300-400 people in the room watching them. But there were 1 million people that were going to see them on the camera. So I had to have them stop playing to the house audience and play to the camera.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and a lot of them had trouble with that at first mm-hmm. because they need that audience response and that you, but I had just like, you have to understand that there are 1 million of people on that camera and only a couple hundred. Which one you want to play to? Make up your mind.
That's it, because that's what I feel like about like Tyler Perry, where I love his plays because that's the space for it. But then when he goes to TV and film, he doesn't adapt to the
medium. Right.
And so it's like with the first Madea movie, it was like that riffing, and it's like, this is, you're on camera, you can't just riff for forever. It works in plays.
Right.
And then like when I was first watching House of Pain, I was like, it's weird. But I couldn't figure it out because I'm not like artistic mm-hmm. in that space, but I was like, something's off. And so that I could see that like he's playing to like an audience more than playing to the camera of like.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Right. And so I had to teach other people. So the camera, you have a one-to-one relationship. Mm-hmm. And I had to learn when I talk to the camera to talk as if I was talking to my best friend, okay. to someone who I loved. Mm-hmm. And if I could master that, seeing my best friend or whoever I loved in that camera lens, mm-hmm. the audience was going to feel that. Mm-hmm. You know, because I don't know, that show, my show in Detroit, was number one from 82 to 87, 88. Mm-hmm. We didn't miss, we were a total hit.
Yeah.
But most of the time, but that's what I was doing when I would talk to the camera. I would talk to the camera as if I was talking to one person. Because if you can master that, talking to that one person, you visualize that person in your mind. Sometimes I was talking to my brother. Sometimes I was talking to my friends. Sometimes, you know, I had to imagine them talking to one person.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to get the comics to understand, is because when the camera gets on them, and it's a one-to-one relationship with whoever's watching.
Right.
It's not that one person is taking this all in. And
yeah.
It's funny thing, I did a telethon, mm-hmm. Jerry Lewis telethon when I was at DIV. And I looked at the camera doing a pitch and I said, you stop doing what you're doing. Put that beer down and listen to me. And you over there, we about to eat that plate of spaghetti, just wait a minute, hold on. And the people who was around me were going like, what, is he tripping? And the funny thing was, after I did all that and did the pitch, I got a call from a friend of mine. He said, man, I thought you were talking, when you said put the beer down, I put my beer down, I thought you were talking to me. And I remember my grandmother. Mm-hmm. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And we were watching television and a cop show was on. And it said, hands up. My grandmother thought it was a person.
Yeah.
She stood up and put her hands up. Uh-huh. So from those, drawing from those kind of experiences, I knew that there was a one-to-one thing you had to master.
Right.
You know, so.
So can you go back to Bless You Boys?
Oh yeah, Bless You Boys. Bless You Boys came about because they wanted a song to the one of the sports announcers came up with "Bless You Boys." What was his name? Damn, what was his name? I hope he's. Oh, you know, he came up. No, Sparky was the Tigers manager. He was a sports announcer. Came up with a slogan, "Bless You Boys." Anyway, they wanted us to come up with a song to go with that. So Randy Jacobs and myself, and who else? It was somebody else. Got together and we came up with "Bless You Boys," the song, and then we put "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" on the other side of the song, the flip side. And it was weird because it became a number one song in Detroit, and I was like, "What?" on the radio. But they were playing it because the Tigers went to World Series that year, and there was a whole big thing, and everything became "Bless You Boys," and everybody was playing the song.
Is it Acid Al?
Al Ackerman.
Al Ackerman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Al Ackerman. Yeah. So, "Bless You Boys" really came about, you know, because they needed a song to go with his slogan, and so, you know, we made a hook on a song.
Yeah. And then you were the producer and host of Saturday Night Music Machine. What does that mean to the culture of Detroit at that time?
Oh man, music
change maker.
Music Machine was a labor of love. Mm-hmm. It gave me a chance. I was a little older by that time, but older than, I mean, I was out of my 20s. I wasn't like old, but I was out of my 20s. Mm-hmm. But it gave me a chance to expose new talent. And I knew Detroit was full of talent because I had, you know, I grew up there, you know, I went to the clubs, you know, when I was younger, I saw all the people I knew. So I knew that there was a treasure trove of talent, untapped talent. Mm-hmm. So out of Go For It, they decided they wanted to do a show that was a talent search show because hundreds, thousands of people lined up to audition. Right. There were very few who weren't good. It wasn't like, you know, you got to find this really good one. No.
Like American Idol.
No.
Like, it was, some people, like, I watched the first week of American Idol just to see the horrible people.
And what the problem in Detroit was, everybody was good. And so they decided, you know, we needed to do something with that. And so myself and a guy by the name of Henry Maldonado and Alan Frank and a guy by the name of Danny DiCarlo, we came up with this with Saturday Night Music Machine as a contest to follow the whole Go For It campaign. Mm-hmm. And it worked. It worked really, really good. And it became number one. And then they wanted to go and take it into syndication. Mm-hmm. Which I thought, oh, cool, syndication. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the second time I'd learned this lesson at DID. Mm-hmm. The first time I learned this lesson was the first syndicated show I did. First syndicated show I did with them was called Showdown at the Palace. It was the first Thomas Hearns, Sugar Leonard fight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was producer, lead producer on that syndicated show. It was syndicated nationally. Manuel Stewart and Prentice Byrd got together with the King World people, and they came to DIV and they wanted to do this, and Prentice Byrd and Manuel Stewart said they weren't going to do it unless a black producer was involved. Mm-hmm. This is Detroit, so it is what it is. You want to do this? This is what you got to do. So, mm-hmm. And I knew Prentice. Prentice was the boyfriend of a woman who became my wife, mm-hmm. And Prentice. said that they should put, because they were like, well, we don't have anybody. And the apprentice was like, yeah, you do. And so I ended up being the lead producer. But the crazy thing was, I was told by certain non-African Americans that my name could not be put at the top of the credits. Because if a black man was producing it, they could not sell it. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I had experienced racism at that kind of level. I had seen it before in media. Mm-hmm. I'd seen it back in the WJBK days. Mm-hmm. The night Coleman Young was elected, I was working in news. Mm-hmm. And when the night started, the non-African Americans, which most of them were, there was only one or two of us who were African American. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were just, he was never going to win. But as the night went on and the election results came back and he won, those same people were in tears and angry. And some of them were vowing to do everything they could mm-hmm. to derail Coleman Young. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking through the television station and I'm hearing this and seeing this. Now, inside, I'm happiest. I mean, I'm like, hey. You know, because a black man had won the election in Detroit. So I'm happy, but I can't show my emotion. Right. I gotta hold it all in. Mm-hmm. I cannot show that. I mean, I'm in the middle of, So that was the first time. And the second thing, when they told me my name could not be put, that was the second time. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things happened. The higher I went up and the more things I did, the more I experienced that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. To the point to where when it got to Saturday Night Music Machine, and nobody really knows this, only very few people know this, Music Machine was number one when it was canceled.
I mean, just like a black show being canceled or a black produced show.
And it was canceled because the syndicators had said that they couldn't syndicate it with a black man as host. So that's why it was taken off the air. Mm-hmm. That was the third time. And that particular time was the one that hurt me the most. Mm-hmm. Took me a long time to get past that.
Yeah.
I knew I had to, because what was I going to do?
Right.
You know, I had to be in the business. You know, if I had made it was my career. So I accepted it, and that's how I ended up leaving Detroit. That was the reason I ended up leaving Detroit, going to LA. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that I had gone as far as I could go mm-hmm. as a black man.
Right.
In that particular genre of television and music and whatnot in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason I left. So, and when I left, I didn't have a job mm-hmm. to go to. I put stuff in my car mm-hmm. and I drove to LA with
so
nothing.
What was in between that and BET?
I ended up coming to LA and got a call from a salesman who was a sales guy, who was the lead sales guy for Saturday Night Music Machine, mm-hmm. Rich Grove, Jewish guy. Rich, he called me, he says, I have this friend at this place called BET. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about BET. Mm-hmm. And they're looking for somebody to come in there and turn that thing around and help them do this, that, and the other. And so, well, what are you doing? What are you, where are you? Where are you? I said, I'm in LA. He said, well, they're in DC. I said, you know, are you interested? I said, yeah, of course I'm interested. I'm, you know, well, I'm not doing a whole lot right now. So, and it was Black. He told me it was a Black channel. So I said, well, that sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. And so they flew me in. And I walked into BET. And I had to hold back the tears. Because I looked around. And there was a sea of Black people. Mm-hmm. Doing jobs. That before that day, I had never seen Black people. That many Black people do in one place. It was an anomaly.
It was like your early Detroit 2.0.
You're right. And I literally had to hold back the tears from crying because it was just, it was like I walked into Disneyland, a Black Disneyland, you know, and it was so refreshing and so, I thinking about it right now, the words can't come to me that can describe the emotions that flowed through me. And so I met this woman by the name of Cindy Mahmood, and she told me that the head of the division wanted to talk to me and find out, you know what I was about. And so I went and talked to a guy by the name of Jeffrey Lee. Mm-hmm. And Jeff was a vice president or senior vice president, executive vice president of programming at that time. And so he said he wanted me to just take a week and just observe everything that was going on. Mm-hmm. And then report back to him what I thought. So I did that. And so when I reported back to him, I said, man, you got good people who love what they're doing. I said, the problem is most of them don't have a clue as to what they're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, you it's like having a football team or basketball team, but there's no coach.
Right.
Everybody it's a street ball. There's no professional coach. There's no coach in there telling, okay, do this, do that, do that. And so they
raw talent, but it has to be polished up.
Right. So that's what I was brought in to do. Mm-hmm. And from that, you know, came a lot of different. I became the head of the West Coast division. Mm-hmm. For Black Entertainment Television, and we did all kinds of shows there. And the reality is, when I first got there in DC, they were doing the crews. They would have a cruise sit around all day, and they would do one show a day. Mm-hmm. But they were there all day. Mm-hmm. So I taught them production technique. I said, look, no. You guys are here and you eat lunch is an hour. not you work an hour and then lunch is 7 hours. No, you got it flipped. So we started kicking out content, just kicking it out. And changed the production procedures. Then they made me the head of the went to the West Coast and ended up being head of the West Coast doing the same kind of stuff. Just taking what I had learned at WDIV and WJBK and what I had learned at IOTC. Mm-hmm. And teaching it to them.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, because I had, like I said, when I came in with IOTC, I had to learn lighting and staging. And I learned everything from the ground up. Mm-hmm. I learned, I mean, everything. And they would put me in a position to learn this, and I just absorbed everything, learned it. So I took all of that, what I had learned in Detroit from syndicating from local television to syndicated television to all of that, the music, I took it all to BET. And
so like you, because I've seen you say before that you duplicated it, what you did, and I did a similar thing like for my my time in the National Urban League movement. Now that I'm concentrating on the animation community, sometimes I just like I take some like panel discussions that I did with the Urban League and be like, well, just put the animation part on it, and I just reuse it. I'm like, I did the work already. Let me just reuse it over here.
Exactly.
So, can you talk about like the transferable skills and the power of gaining those skills in a smaller environment, but being able to apply it to the same skills on a bigger stage?
Well, you have to. What I did was because I fell in love with the people at BET, mm-hmm. it was easier. It would have been more difficult for me if I had been in a different environment.
Right.
But because I was in that environment, mm-hmm. it made it easier because I was talking to family.
Yeah.
And if there was a particular employee that had a little chip on their shoulder and whatnot, I'd just take them off into the corner and look here, man. Can we just do this? Can we just, you know, give me a break? You know, let's do this right. You know, there's no, I ain't mad at you. You're not mad at me. We're just trying to do a job. So it became the family-like atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And that atmosphere made it easier for me to transfer those skills.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to explain because I was just doing it.
Right.
I wasn't thinking about doing it. Yeah. It wasn't a thought process. It was love.
Yeah.
You know, when you can incorporate love into any situation, it just flows.
Mm-hmm. I fell in love with the people. You know, we did so many amazing things, and with the budgets that they had to work with were far below the budgets that I was used to working with. And discrimination reared its ugly head because they weren't able to charge advertisers the same as mainstream mm-hmm. television. So their advertising, their revenue base was a lot smaller. So a lot of that, you know, had to be taken into consideration. So, you know, we started cranking out stuff and we did the biggest thing we did and that was a breakout was a show called Tribute to Black Music Legends. Mm-hmm. In which I was looking at my Primetime Emmy nomination from that show yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I was executive producer, and the director. You know, I was directing live directing. Mm-hmm. And it was hosted by Robert Townsend, Felicia Richard, mm-hmm. choreographed by Debbie Allen.
Mm-hmm.
We shot it in Pasadena with four stages in a round. A full orchestra, it was slamming. I mean, I was so proud of that show, I know what to do. We were nominated for an Emmy. And first Emmy nomination BET had ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost to the three tenors. Now, I'm not going to say that it was anything weird, but you got three big white guys stand up on stage just singing opera. Mm-hmm. That's all. They're not dancing. They're not just singing.
Right.
You have an orchestra. And on the black side, you got the orchestra. You got Debbie Allen doing choreography with dancers. You got actors, singers, dancers, Broadway production company. You got full camera. You got everything.
Mm-hmm.
Original music being all of that.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the Emmys, but so but anybody who can take and look at those shows today side by side, you make your own decision on what
right.
was going on there. But that was a big from that. We did the BET Awards.
Yeah, so talk about why was it important for us to have our own award show?
Well, truly, I really wasn't feeling an award show because there were too many award shows. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a, I'm not sure there was a black award show, but you know, we had, there was too many award shows, and I couldn't see a real reason for the expenditure, because that was the highest, that show, the budget for that show was the biggest budget that BET had ever,
yeah,
you know. And so, but what I figured out was, I knew from the experience with Tribute to Black Music Legends that this would probably be the highest rated show that network had had. Mm-hmm. And so at that particular time, they had made me, that was after Comic View, they had made me the head of the programming for the network. And I knew that I would have a big audience. And so what I had to do was program it so that whatever came up after that, after that show, after the next day, and whatnot, we had, that's when we had to kick off our new season of programming, because we would have new eyeballs.
Yeah.
So that's really the reason that did, the real reason that we did the award show, to just pick up new eyeballs.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, we had done Comic View, and Comic View was nothing more than Music Machine, to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. Comic View was Music Machine. And I took the same stuff we did with Music Machine in Detroit and just transferred it to comics and took the singers out and put comics in. I didn't do anything else.
Comic View was so monumental in my childhood. Like, Ed from the Culture, like, R&SJ, Lil Duval, My Soror, Cheryl Underwood, Montana
Taylor, I love Cheryl.
Chocolate, mm-hmm. Some more, Don D.C. Curry, Benji Brown, Tyler Craig, T.P. Hearn, Bruce, LaBelle Crawford, like, all these people, like, that probably would have gotten that stage. I was like, yes, they are funny.
But remember what I said about Detroit and Saturday Night Music Machine? All the really good singers?
Yeah.
The same thing, except they were comics.
Right.
You know, a lot of really good comics who didn't have the platform to showcase themselves like we were going to do. I mean, because the difference between us and Def Jam is they couldn't curse on my show. No cursing, no, because I wanted, and you know, the church lady popped in my head, so so I had to deal with the church lady and the reverend in my head, so so anyway, that popped in, so they couldn't curse, and you know, but it was basically Music Machine. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, but the award show, you know, what we did was, and let me go back. The thing about BET was, again, we had, BET was basically FUBU, for us, by us. Mm-hmm. We had a standing thing that if a non-black advertiser or anybody else wanted to do a deal with BET, they had to bring a black representative to speak for them. Mm-hmm. You weren't going to sit down with anybody at BET in those days, mm-hmm. if you didn't have somebody black representing you. If you weren't black, that just wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't. I had only run into that one time before. Like, you know, I'll go back. I had run into it when I was at DIV. When I was at DIV, out of Music Machine and all that stuff, we, and back in, was like 81, we developed a program that we wanted to do with Motown. So we flew out to LA and presented to Motown. And Motown, the Motown executive who's in charge, I'm not going to say what the name is, loved it. Uh-huh. But after we made the pitch, the Motown executive said to the white executive who was Post Newsweek, who came with me, he said to them, well, we can do a 50-50 deal with Motown. And this person said, stop. any deal with Motown would be a minimal of 50-50. And the only reason we even talking to you, white man, is because we like Curtis. Mm-hmm. That came from that. That was Motown. Mm-hmm. I was like, ooh. And so the same kind of stuff was happening at BET. Mm-hmm. You couldn't deal with us unless you came righteous. I mean, even down to the unions. You know, AFTRA tried to come to this is a story that only two other people know. Mm-hmm. When AFTRA tried to come into Comic View, I was a union guy. I had been with the UAW. So I was like, I wasn't against unions. Mm-hmm. Of course. But I asked them a couple of questions. I said, first of all, in order for me to meet with you, you got to bring a black executive. They didn't have one. In those days, mm-hmm. they, in the Comic View days, they didn't have one. Mm-hmm. So they reached out to got a black woman who was, she was not an executive, but she worked for the company. Mm-hmm. She later on got an executive job, but I made them come to a soul food restaurant to meet with me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I did. I made them eat greens and cornbread, and I made them eat pig feet. I did. And we sat and we talked, and I said, I'm not against unions, you know, and I will, here's what I would do. I had been told not to talk to AFTRA, to the union, but mm-hmm. I knew the worst thing you can do to a union is not talk to them. Right. You can talk to them, even if you say no, but yeah. You got to talk to them.
Right.
So I said, you do one thing, just one thing, and I will go back to my superiors, and I will, on your behalf, I will speak on your behalf if you do this one thing. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh yeah, one thing? I said, what? I said, at any given time, BET employs between 200, 300, sometimes 400 employees, depending on the production and where we are in our production season. And I want you to go to ABC, NBC, CBS, Universal, all HBO, everybody you deal with. And I want you to petition them to hire the same amount of African-Americans that we hire. Mm-hmm. If you do that, I will be on your side, and I will petition for Comic View and everything else, anything else you want, I will do that. Mm-hmm. They looked at me like I had grown another head. That was the end of the conversation. Never heard back from them again. Mm-hmm. Until after the BET sale. Mm-hmm. And but that was the rule. And I got all this from Detroit. The Detroit aura, the Detroit energy, once I got there, Detroit energy was all over BET. Mm-hmm. I just put that, you might as well call it Little Detroit, because, you know, although D.C. was a chocolate city of itself, yeah. Mm-hmm. but the stuff I was putting, the media stuff, it was not a black media empire by at that time by any stretch of the imagination, but I took all that stuff and put it with BET, and you know, we were successful.
What can you say about what Comic View meant to the comedians?
Well, they didn't really understand what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And what I was doing was creating jobs. What I was doing was creating jobs for black producers, directors, black writers, black staging people who weren't able, that wouldn't be hired anywhere else, not because they couldn't do the jobs, but because of the reality of the politics of the time. So what I was doing was not only creating a platform for the comedians, but creating a platform for African-American production workers, television production workers, mm-hmm. where black producers, black writers, I took a person who was a receptionist on the front desk. And I would come into work, and every day I would see her, this receptionist writing. She's writing a script. And I said, what are you doing? She says, I'm writing a script. I said, well, let me read it. Let me look at it. And so I looked at it, and I end up making her the head writer for Comic View, writing. And she ended up being my second at Comic View and taking over once I got kicked upstairs. Mm-hmm. Her name was Shelley Brown. Jim Brown, the Hall of Fame football player, Jim Brown, his daughter.
Nice.
Got her first job because I refused to go outside of the lines, mm-hmm. and bring in people who didn't look like us, mm-hmm. to do the stuff that I knew we could do, right. given the chance.
And I thought it was an important part of her story that she was doing it. She was a receptionist, but she was doing it. I feel like a lot of people, like younger people, it's all in their head. And it's like, have you done it, though? Are you producing the work that you want to do?
Right.
That's all. And she was doing it. How can I help you?
She was doing it for free. She was just doing it out of the love of it. Mm-hmm. And see, that's what I was talking about. They were doing stuff. Love had a lot to do with the growth of BET. You know, and so a mate brought Shelly in, and she became my second. She, in fact, by the time it ended, she was a showrunner. Shelly was running stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And I remember I was at a, after that was over, I was at a production in New York with Stephon Marbury, mm-hmm. the basketball player. Mm-hmm. And he was interviewing Jim Brown. And Jim, Jim came up to me, shook my hand, and hugged me. And I was like, okay, I don't know Jim Brown, but okay. And then he explained to me who Shelly was. I didn't know Shelly was his daughter because she didn't put that out there.
Right.
You know, and he told me she was his daughter, and he was thankful and grateful for me to give her a shot and whatnot. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that BET was like an employment agency for African-American producers, directors, writers. It was the place where you could go and practice your craft.
Yeah.
And so that was the biggest thing about Comic View was that it was basically an employer of hundreds of African-Americans, it's like everything else at BET. Mm-hmm. You know, we were feeding people. We were feeding Black families. You know, we were feeding single moms who were producers or writers, or we were feeding people, you know, giving people positions where they could, if they weren't already in the craft, they could learn on the job. Because I look back on me, I learned all this on the job. Nobody trained me. And I went to IA and I learned lighting and theater and all this stuff on the job. So I just took what was given to me and gave it back.
Yeah.
There was no, you know, it was the church lady and the reverend talking to me. Yeah. you know, you give it back. And so I along with Cindy and a few other people, we basically trained people, mm-hmm. who didn't have jobs in that, and it was a labor of love.
Yeah.
And like I said, once I got everybody up to speed and trained, that's when we started to kick ass. Mm-hmm. That's when we really started to make noise because once Comic View really took off and we had some other shows that were taking off, and mm-hmm. I moved the news to Times Square, mm-hmm. and we overlooked Times Square, and we took 106 and come up with 106 and Park in New York. We were kicking ass.
Washington Park is another thing that was monumental in my childhood.
and we were killing them, mm-hmm. and that's a big reason why BT was was sold, because we were just, if we had kept going, we would have destroyed MTV. I mean, we would, because we were, our handicap was, when we first started, nobody understood what they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
But now that everybody was understanding what they were supposed to do, mm-hmm. and we're beginning to pull in people who knew what they were supposed to do, Black people who knew what they were supposed to do, mm-hmm. there was no stopping us. If we were had been allowed to keep going, we would have.
And you created Seals Word with your son. Honestly, my interview with Kitty Kaboom is at one of my biggest videos on my channel.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kitty. The way Sita started was Corey had come back from Israel. He had a job in Israel, mm-hmm. Working on motion capture. Mm-hmm. And he came back, that job had ended. He came back and I had a house in Altadena in the hills, and we were sitting around the pool, and he was telling me about recapping what he had been doing for the last, you know, for a few months. And I was like, I've got to think. I said, okay. And he was telling me about the whole gaming thing. And I was like, And I listened. I said, well, can you do this, and with that? And he was like, yeah. I said, well, okay. I said, can you do it live, in real time? He's like, no, we can't do it. I said, well, then no, we can't talk. He said, well, maybe I can. And so it took about a year of developing him going back and forth, trying to figure out how to do this as close to live as we could get. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that if I could do it that way, I could have an edge on everybody.
Yeah.
If I could turn those episodes out quickly, you know, because I could doing them one day at a time, like movies or whatnot. No, that, right. That did not work. The economics of that didn't work. So once he figured out a way to crank out the shows, that's when I gave him the green light, and we went on ahead and did Cedar, and we were sick, because what I really wanted to do, the direction I was going to take BET in, is into gaming, because there were no Black people in gaming,
right,
at that time. And I don't know, it's not, probably not a bunch of them in it right now, but
when I graduated in 2008, I moved to New Orleans, and there was a company called Energized Entertainment, and they came out with a video game with Doug Williams. It was like a HBCU video game where you could play as a player or a drum major or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the Doug Williams version, and that's the only like Black gaming studio, and they were very small, and because they were mm-hmm. out of Baton Rouge, and so that's the only like Black gaming studio I've ever heard of. Not ever heard of, maybe, but like at least back then.
Well, that's the direction I was taking everything in to go off into that, because gaming, I knew gaming, because I would sit there with Corey and we would play those games, and we played games all day. I mean, it would just go and go and go and go. And I realized this is a serious business. So that's the business I wanted to take BET. That was going to be my next move. Mm-hmm. If I was allowed to do the things I wanted to do, that would have been my next move, was to take BET into the gaming area, because that's where it needed to be. Yeah. So, but that was the move on CETA, when we did CETA, and we did a lot of groundbreaking stuff. But again, it was because of the formula. I had a formula, mm-hmm. and the formula was not to use actors or actresses or those kind of people who already had something going.
Right.
Because they already had something going. They didn't really need us. I mean, you got something going. Mm-hmm. Do what you got to do. And plus, the cost of doing that would have meant that I couldn't hire as many Black directors and writers, and because they would have absorbed all the cost.
Yeah.
So I had to make a conscious decision. Okay. Are we going to be basically a Black employment agency and employ as many people as we can and feed as many people as we can? Or are we going to have one or two shows that do it, yeah. and the rest, everything else takes a hit? No, but I wanted to do something that nobody had done at that particular time, and that was employ hundreds, you know, more people than we were already doing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just take it and go off and go off into video games, go off into movies and the whole. I mean, Bob. I remember Bob was trying to go off into movies. He was trying to do a movie studio too at the time. And as I remember, he couldn't get any of the known black successful actors to really sign up on that, because they were at that particular time, I think they were thought that if they signed with BET, it would hurt them. Mm-hmm. You know, and we ran into that a lot.
Yeah.
And when we tried to do a late night show, that was a problem. You know, because if the blacks who were doing the mainstream late night shows did our show, the mainstream wouldn't allow them on their shows. Mm-hmm. So I had a tendency to lean away from the blacks who that were connected in the mainstream and take African Americans who had not had a shot and give them a shot.
And I mean, that was the whole celebrities, because AJ and Free hits from the streets, Sita, like they became our people. Right. All the people on BET Comic View, like they became our people.
Right. I mean, and it wasn't that they weren't talented; just they didn't have a venue. Mm-hmm. So what we did, you know, and I give all props to Bob, mm-hmm. you know, because if it wasn't for two people, Bob Johnson and a guy by the name of Lewis Carr, who was the head of sales. If it wasn't for those two guys, all that stuff wouldn't have happened, because they gave me the permission to go and do the things that need to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, and Bob gave me the budgets and that kind of stuff to do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, between Bob and Lewis was the sales guy. Lewis was the first sales guy who I had ever gotten with, because I had relationships with King World and their salespeople. Mm-hmm. I had relationships with salespeople at Fox, and I knew what they thought. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, but Lewis was in sales and he was a brother. Mm-hmm. So I became partnered up with Lewis, and we were just, you know, the way I came up with, you know how I came up with budgets? Bob would say, Lewis, you and Curtis, and I would just want to know, well, Lewis, what can you sell it for? Mm-hmm. And Lewis would say, it can sell for this. And that's the budget. That became the budget. Uh-huh. You know, it was so cool, mm-hmm. you know, the things that we were doing.
I remember seeing the Boogeyman logo and whatnot on BT. Where did the nickname the Boogeyman come from?
When I was in Detroit, again, Detroit, when I was in Detroit and doing Music Machine, Music Machine was a big show, but I wasn't making any money. Mm-hmm. I was probably one of the lowest paid people at DIV. I wasn't making any money on that show. Mm-hmm. It was done, you know, basically they were making money and we were trying to do the syndication thing. But mm-hmm. what came out of it was, I became a local celebrity. And I noticed, I was walking down the street one day and a car pulled over and stopped and said, Curtis Gadsden, what are you doing walking on the street? Where's your limo? I'm like, huh? Where's your limo? Because the beginning of the show had me getting out of a limo.
Oh.
And then, where's your limo? I go like, limo? Talking about you walking in the street. I said, I got two legs. So what I realized though was that people, when you're recognized, mm-hmm. people expect certain things. Mm-hmm. They expect you to act a certain way, to live a certain way, to do certain things. And I was not really interested in the celebrity part of it. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in the job itself.
Right.
You know, so the Boogeyman came about because I could do stuff without people knowing who I was. I could just go about, do my job, do what I do. And nobody knew on the national level, nobody knew Curtis Gadsden, but on the local level, on Detroit level, everybody knew who I was, but I didn't repeat that same mistake. So I used the boogeyman so I could move and talk to people. Because people, if they think you're somebody, they will tell you what they want you to know. They will tell you what they think you want to hear.
Yeah.
But if you're just a person off the street that they're talking to about whatever, they tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. They don't sugarcoat it. They don't change it. They don't. And that's what I really wanted to hear. When I got kicked up to a head programming for BET, I didn't want people knowing that I was the head of programming, because they're going to tell you what they wanted. I mean, the bourgeois people are going to tell you what they want. The regular people are going to tell you what they want. Everybody's going to be telling you a lie. You're never going to get the truth from anybody. Mm-hmm. But if they don't know who you are, they just think that they're talking to some guy off the street, they will be real.
Right.
And I based all of my decisions on what the real people said they wanted.
Yeah.
So that's why the boogeyman came about. It was a tool so that I could still be anonymous and go to the barbershop, go to the disco, go to the bar, go to whatever, and just talk to people about, what do you think about that show that BET has on? And people would tell me exactly what they thought. Uh-huh. What do you think about that MTV show? People would tell me exactly what they thought. Uh-huh. Not knowing who they were talking to. You know, so that's how that came about.
With all this access to technology that people have, the information, the great cameras on your phone and more, like what do you hope and wish Black people are doing in this current landscape that you maybe even wish you could have done coming up, like in creating their own content? And some of them, I mean, they're obviously doing it as well, but
I think we are missing the boat. On a financial level. Mm-hmm. I think the only real freedom is economic freedom. The rest of it is smoke and mirrors. The rest of it is like, it's an illusion.
Yeah.
So I think that we must learn to make brooms. Now, what do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. If, listen, you have a production company, we have a production company, somebody else has a production company, some other Black person has all these different production companies. I look at them as straws. Mm-hmm. Just separate straws. If you gather up all those straws, wrap them up, you got a broom.
Yeah.
And with a broom, you can do a lot more with a broom and you can do with one damn straw. So I think Black people need to be thinking about making damn brooms. Mm-hmm. Putting all these straws together and quit going, I've got this and that. Put your egos aside for the cause. Mm-hmm. And make some damn brooms. Are we gonna make a lot of money at the beginning? No. I'm working with some people right now, some young guys right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not getting paid for it, mm-hmm. but I'm teaching them everything from A to Z that I know, because I want them to make brooms.
Yeah.
Band together. Because that was really the success of BET. BET was not just BET. People understand. BET was the Black producers, directors, and all that, but it was also Black advertising agencies that work with BET. Mm-hmm. It was Black marketing people who weren't working for BET. They had their own companies. BET was Black folks who got their jobs with Coca-Cola because BET refused to talk to anybody that didn't have a Black representative come in. Mm-hmm. So they created jobs at other companies, and your job was to talk to BET. So the beauty of what where we are today is there are a lot more Black people that know what to do.
Yeah.
The problem is we're not making brooms. Mm-hmm. And just a bunch of straws.
Roots, I feel like that I got that from like every corner store church. Like it'll be like a church on every corner, and it's like if y'all come together, y'all can have 10 members.
Exactly. 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 I had an idea I was trying to get preachers to do. Mm-hmm. On Sunday the church is full. Mm-hmm. Well, at least it used to be. I don't know if it even, but anyway, they got more members on Sunday than they do any other day.
Yeah.
What's happening with that church the rest of the week?
Mm-hmm. And that's how Kevin on Stage did his first tour, is renting out churches.
What a church is really a movie theater to me. We could do Black movies and premiere them in all the mega churches at the same time. That's a broom. You see, the key to success in any of this is distribution.
Right.
Distribution for movies is the theaters.
Right.
Distribution for television are the streaming services and all of that. There's some Black streaming services, but they're barely making it work because everybody's going to the others. Mm-hmm. Well, until we understand that the only real freedom is economic freedom, mm-hmm. until we really understand that, if we're just a bunch of straws being blown around in the wind.
Yeah.
You blow this way and you blow that way and you blow this way. When you come together as a broom and you can build bamboo with that straw and fortify.
Yeah.
You can sweep with that broom and sweep up all the
braid.
Weave it, braid, all of that. Make brooms, mm-hmm. and stop being single straws. We will never, never, ever succumb the current. Give me, how much buying power do African Americans have?
We're like the fifth or sixth largest country in the world.
So if you make a good broom, mm-hmm. can we sweep up 1% of that? 2% of that? Mm-hmm. We're not thinking like that. We're thinking about going up. Not, when the company that I want to do is the company that understands, okay, the Black buying power are trillions of dollars. Whatever that number is, I don't know what that, but mm-hmm. what does it take for us to carve out 3%, 5%, whatever it is? That's the vision I have,
right.
is to tackle this thing from a backwards engineering standpoint. Pick a number we're trying to achieve. What is that number we're trying to hit? Now let's backwards engineer ourselves into that number. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what they did at BET. They would give me a number, give me a budget number. I would backward engineer the creative vision into that number. Mm-hmm. I didn't go in there going, you got to go do a pilot. We didn't do no damn pilots. Pilot? Are you kidding me? We can't afford to. The pilot got to hit the air. There's no, but you understand that you have to backward engineer into that number. So if we pick, if there was a broom, you know, a company, a Black owned operated company that could draw the right people together, mm-hmm. I know Bob tried to do it, and he did to a certain level, but then other things happened and that I can't talk about other things happen. But anyway,
right.
if you can create that broom, mm-hmm. then that answers a lot of our questions, because once you create the first broom, the other Black folks gonna create brooms.
Yeah.
And other black folks gonna create brooms. Mm-hmm. And there's gonna be brooms everywhere. And then you're gonna take all those brooms and have a street sweeper.
That's the exact thing I had in my head, street sweeper.
You know what I mean? So we gotta start thinking like that.
Yeah.
On a larger scale. You know, like Corey's always getting after me. You always thinking huge, big. I can't help it. That's all I know how to do. I don't know how to think small.
Right.
You know, Bob, I remember Bob told me, he told somebody else, this was Bob saying, we would have these small budgets. And I said, Bob, I was taking this from something my old boss had told me from that he had his dealings with Bob. I said, Bob, you asking us to go into a gunfight with a stick. You give these little bitty budgets. He's like thinking of it as a big stick. And so my thing is, let's think about brooms.
Yeah.
Make some brooms.
I try to think of ideas. My thought is like, because I have a lot of Google Docs and whatever that I have ideas just in case somebody want to give me money one day. But my idea is to think about ideas so big so that God can laugh at me and then give me something bigger.
Right. So that's my dream, mm-hmm. is to create, you know, a broom. After I left BET, a lot of people didn't want to touch me after I left BET because I was just too dangerous. People, I remember I tried to get a white person to invest in what I was doing, mm-hmm. and he said, "You have a great idea. But I will never invest with a smart nigga." A white guy told me that. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna do that. He was like, I'm not gonna invest in a smart nigga. Mm-hmm. I had the hardest time getting stuff going.
Yeah.
Because that was the mentality of a lot of the others.
Yeah.
But, you know, my time, you know, is shorter than it was years ago. So my job now is just to inform, mm-hmm. instruct, pass on the knowledge to whoever I can pass it on to, and hopefully y'all can make some brooms.
Yeah. So my last question is, if somebody was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your work in entertainment?
My children. My mother used to tell women who were interested in me, she was asking, "Why are you interested in him?" My mama would say that. "Why are you interested in him? He is never gonna love you like he loves his job." She would tell him, she said, "He loves his work." And that's the way it was for me for the longest time until I had kids. The women didn't inspire that in me. They just didn't. I mean, they just didn't. Okay, fine. You know. But my children, mm-hmm. inspired me to do things for them. And to make sacrifices and to do things that I wouldn't have done if it weren't for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it went into a higher or even more intense level when I had grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Then my whole every day I get up, live and breathe. Okay, how can I set them up? How can I set them up so they can further this whole thing? I mean, I'm training my grandson to do, you know, what Corey and everybody's doing. Corey's training his sons to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm training all my grandchildren. I'm being groomed for different positions as my children. What people understand, you know, I used to bring my children to work. I used to bring my son, my daughter, and Corey, they went to work with me at BET. Mm-hmm. They worked at BET. My youngest, he was in high school. In vacations, he'd come out and work at BET. Mm-hmm. And my daughter worked at BET. And the reason I had them working at BET is because I knew I was going to be working. I mean, I would go to work sometimes I go to work on Wednesday, come home on Sunday. Mm-hmm. But if my children were there,
okay.
I get up from my desk and go see what they're doing and then come back. I still live for my children today, mm-hmm. and my grandchildren, my grandson, you know, my grandsons. And I got three grandsons, two granddaughters, and they are my blood grandsons and granddaughters. But then I got some that aren't my blood, but still my children. So,
yeah.
You know, but that's what I, that's for me. Because I truly feel that a mark of a man has little or nothing to do with what he does. Mm-hmm. It has to do more to do with, he can call himself a success if his children are successful. Mm-hmm. And he had a hand in it. Mm-hmm. He can call himself a success if his grandchildren our success, and he had a hand in it. Mm-hmm. In my mind, in my world, that's a mark of a man. Mm-hmm. Look at the success of his children, his grandchildren. If they have been are successful because of something he did, mm-hmm. then he is a success. But don't come telling me, well, I've done this and I've done that, and it stops with you. Come on now. not me. I take more pride in what Corey has done and Patrick, my grandson. Patrick is my youngest son. Mm-hmm. You can look him up on LinkedIn, Curtis Patrick Gatson. He is a Wall Street lawyer. Mm-hmm. He's got a double Ivy. He's got a degree from a Cornell and a law degree from Columbia. He is equity owner in one of the largest Wall Street law firms in the world. Nice. His, because he is success, he'll tell you, he'll tell anybody, my dad created this monster. But that's my pride in what I can help them do right now. I'm working on stuff with Corey. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's tough going, and he's like, but he gonna make it, and it's gonna be fine. Mm-hmm. That becomes my success when he's successful.
Yeah,
it becomes my success when my daughter's successful. Mm-hmm. That's my success. With the things that I've done, the awards I've won, every kind of award you can think of. In television, and Corey tells people all the time, the Emmys that Dad won, he uses them at doorstops, because my award is my children, and what I have taught them and what I can teach them. Nothing else really matters to me. You can give me any kind of praise you want to give me. It if it doesn't trickle to my children, it don't mean a thing.
Yeah. So I would love to thank you for coming on my platform and allowing me to highlight you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
And to everyone out there, I want you to like so I know it's real. Comment and tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Citadel and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.